Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Hello and welcome to Matters of Life and Death. This week is our third and final instalment of John's conversation with the Astronomer Royal, Lord Martin Rees. Normal MOLAD service resumes next week. See you then.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of The Big Conversation from Premier Unbelievable. It's been so good to be joined by John Wyatt. He's the author of The Robot Will See You Now, exploring where technology and transhumanism is taking humanity from a Christian perspective. If you want more from John, johnwyatt.com, and do check out the Matters of Life and Death podcast from Premier Unbelievable that he hosts with his journalist son, Tim. Joining us today on the show has been Lord Martin Rees, who is the Astronomer Royal, former Master of Trinity College, Cambridge, former President of the Royal Society, many other illustrious titles that I could list. But his recent book, On the Future, Prospects for Humanity, is really the central sort of ideas from that we've been discussing today when we were looking at robots and transhumanism, life beyond Earth. MartinRees.uk for Martin's website. I did want to open up that question of what, you know, the long future may look like. I've mentioned transhumanism, and there's lots of ways in which that crosses over between, you know, robotics and biotech and everything, but people even question whether humans will be part of the future. You referenced this a bit earlier, Martin. I know that you've also published another recent book called The End of Astronauts, where you've said, really, humans won't be involved in space travel in the future, which is a rather sad prospect, really. Doesn't sound quite as romantic, you know, to say, you know, rather than one small step for man, you know, it's one small step for a robot somewhere in a distant galaxy. I mean, just explain why you think actually on that level, you know, if there is going to be further exploration of space, it won't involve humans, it'll involve robots. What's your reasoning for that, Martin?
Well, robots are becoming vastly more capable, of course, and the practical need for humans in space is going down, because robots can now assemble big structures in orbit, or they could build a structure on the moon, a big telescope or something. And if you think about exploring, then robots on Mars will soon be able to actually do what a geologist could do. They can already travel around Mars and dig up bits, samples, but soon they'll have a bit of more intelligence and they could do it better. So, of course, they could do these things, and of course they're hugely cheaper. If you want to send a person to Mars, then you've got to feed them, keep them safe for a 200-day trip, and perhaps bring them back. And that's hugely more expensive than sending a robot, which just hibernates and you can leave there. And so the practical case for humans is getting weaker. And obviously, as you say, there's an inspiration in sending humans. We look back, if we're old enough, to Neil Armstrong's One Small Step on the Moon in 1969. And that was the high point of exploration in space. No one's been further than the moon since. So the line I take in my book is that if we are going to have humans going into space in future, then they should go as an adventure. And this should be, I think, not paid for by the taxpayer, because if the taxpayers send civilians into space, they've got to be very risk averse. Whereas if the billionaires pay for it, then first of all, it's not our money in the same sense. But secondly, they can launch the kind of adventurers, people like Sir Ranulph Fiennes or people who go hang gliding and all that, and even some people who will be willing to go with one-way tickets. In fact, Musk himself has said that he wants to die on Mars, but not on impact. He's now, I think, 51, and when he's 90, maybe he could go, and we should cheer him on. You know, I think robots, of course, can do all the exploration, and they can, of course, go far beyond Mars, where humans never could. But the role of humans is nonetheless very interesting, because supposing that there is a small community of these bold pioneers living on Mars, which would be less comfortable than living at the South Pole or the ocean bed, but there could be people there, then at the end of a century, they will want to use all the techniques we will then have for genetic modification and cyborg to adapt their progeny to this very hostile environment, very different from the Earth. Now, here on Earth, we're pretty well adapted, and also we are going to regulate all these techniques for ethical and prudential reasons. But these guys on Mars are away from the regulators. And so my line in our book is that if there is going to be a sort of post-human species, it will be the progeny of those crazy pioneers on Mars who will have the incentive and not the constraints which we will have on Earth. So that can happen. And of course, this leads to the question of the far future, because we know that the solar system has billions of years ahead of it. And in even a few centuries, then there may be a species different from humans, maybe mainly robotic. And if they are electronic rather than of flesh and blood, then they may not want to stay on a planet. They both need an atmosphere. They may prefer zero gravity, and they'll be near immortal, so they could go on interstellar voyages. So a scenario for the far future is that entities which are electronic progeny of humans who went to Mars will spread through the galaxy. And of course, this raises a question which astronomers always asked: are there aliens out there already, or will the galaxy be awaiting our progeny? We don't know. But electronic entities may be our remote descendants and the ones who can actually go out into deep space. And that, of course, still begs the question of whether they will be zombies or whether they'll be intelligent, but they will be capable of surviving for millions of years and making these long voyages.
Be interested in your thoughts on...
So that's a scenario for the long-term future.
John, what do you think of this sort of idea of post-humans who are effectively, advanced robots who are actually our ancestors? Once we've, I don't know, died out or Earth becomes uninhabitable, it's them that will be taking things forward in the far future.
I mean, it's a fascinating prospect, isn't it? And I think it's much closer to science fiction. These are very common science fiction tropes.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think one of the fascinating things about this, technology is that whereas previously, whenever a new technology came, we got the technological advance first, and then we got the artists and the writers and the novelists who wrote about it. You know, so we have the Industrial Revolution, and then Dickens writes about it and so on. What's unique about this revolution is that right from sort of Mary Shelley and H.G. Wells, people have been speculating about the future of the human race and the technology and post-humanism and so on. And so there's a very interesting interaction between the science fiction and then the actual technology. And I know that some of the technologists in Silicon Valley, they're actually trying to make the science fiction come true. I mean, Elon Musk has said how much his science fiction background and Asimov, Foundation and Empire, all these kind of big themes of life across a galaxy, he's now trying to make this come true. I mean, my own perspective is that I suspect the drive for human enhancement is going to be massive on this planet, not just on Mars. In many ways, what we're seeing already is a kind of low-tech human enhancement. I mean, you know, the idea of cosmetic surgery, of gender-changing surgery, of recreational pharmaceuticals, of, you know, this is all low-tech transhumanism. And what's going to happen? And it shows that there is a sort of inexhaustible appetite for us to improve our bodies. And I suspect that as the technology advances, there's going to be more and more demand for sophisticated technology to improve our bodies. And I think the question we're going to have to ask is, are we satisfied? I think there's going to be a campaign for real humanity. You know, there's a campaign for real ale that says, you know, we don't want this this kind of fizzy stuff. I think there's going to have to be campaigns for real humanity. You know, that we think, actually, you know what? I think this old-fashioned Mark One Homo sapiens, I'm quite satisfied with that.
What about you, Martin?
Yes. No, I completely agree with that. I think we ought to restrain all these developments. We should restrain all these developments here on Earth, because we're well adapted to the Earth, and we don't want to change it too fast. I agree with that. And that's why I think it will be the crazy guys on Mars who are away from the regulators and who are ill-adapted and have reasons for trying to change their descendants. So I think they will pioneer these things, and we should cheer them on, but we should restrain that happening here. And to take a more recent example, there's the establishment just very recently of three labs called Altos Laboratories to extend lifespan. These are funded by billionaires who, when young, wanted to be rich, and now they're rich, they want to be young again, and that's not quite so easy. And there's one in San Francisco, one in San Diego, and one in Cambridge. And I think if they succeeded in enhancing the lifespan of a few privileged people, that's a really fundamental kind of inequality. And that's something I think we ought to put the brakes on. I mean, even if everyone could do it, it's not obviously a good idea. But certainly a few people who have conquered death to a greater extent than the rest of us is a really fundamental kind of inequality. So I'm very much on side that since we are adapted to living on the Earth, we've got to preserve it as it is, and to a reasonable extent preserve ourselves, and distinguish between remedying defects and enhancement.
I was going to ask then,
one is less good.
In that case, Martin, I mean, as someone who doesn't have any particular religious beliefs, why for you is there that sense of sadness at the idea that humans might one day go extinct and be replaced by, you know, some sort of robotics, you know, advanced technology that we had created? Because as you said, some people just say, well, we're just this blip in, you know, a vast, you know, cosmos going on through billions of years. Why should we privilege our particular moment in the sun over what may come after us? Why is it just a sort of sentimental attachment to humans? What is it, Martin?
Well, I mean, I suppose there's a kind of chauvinism, being a human being myself. I mean, I do care about our species, and I admire the beauty and wonder of this world and its variety, etc., in which we have evolved over a 4 billion year process, and I think we want to cherish this. But nonetheless, in the broader perspective, there may be all kinds of life out there already, even more wonderful than the Earth, and there could be descendants, if you think on timescales of millions of years, not just centuries, descendants of humans who also are very different. So I think in the grand cosmic perspective, then we may be just a blip. But I think we are entitled to a bit of chauvinism for the human species.
What kind of drives your particular concern, John, for seeing humans flourish rather than, you know, some robot ancestors of ours flourish?
Well, I think that astronomers and other thinkers like Martin Rees, who don't believe in any kind of fundamental meaning, actually have a problem, because there's a famous quote by the physicist Weinberg, who said, the more the universe is comprehensible, the more it seems pointless. And it's that as we talked earlier about this human longing for meaning, for longing for significance. And so I think that we need some bigger story than just, well, you know, we happen to be a sort of cosmic accident which happened to evolve for completely meaningless reasons, and we happened by a great fluke to enjoy it, and then we went out, bonk. You know, that I think there is a deep hunger for something more than that.
Martin?
I mean, I think I disagree in two respects. First, I think we can make our own meaning in lives. I don't feel my life is meaningless. I think most people can make a meaning in life and look at human achievements and try and ensure that we improve things. That's one thing. The second point is that even if we would like the universe to have a meaning, that doesn't mean it does. So our wishes are not the same as the reality. So that's why I don't sympathise with these views. But I think we've got to make the best meaning we can. And we certainly know that there's a huge gap, indeed I think a widening gap, between the way the world is and the way it could be. And our aim should be to narrow that gap. And I think we should do that as human beings. I don't think any perception about what is happening in the wider cosmos should diminish our motivation to make meaning here on Earth.
John, any response to that?
Well, I still struggle with how you can have... I mean, I think what Martin is expressing is a view which is often said, is that basically ethics, morality, all of these are just human inventions, which our clever human minds sort of invent. You know, we invent that certain things are good and certain things are evil. We pretend that it matters whether you love people or whether you torture them. But actually it doesn't. These are just stories we tell ourselves. There is no fundamental linkage between morality and reality out there. And I think most people really... would struggle with that, and my own belief, you know, as a Christian, is that actually morality is objective. It's out there. We don't invent it, we discover it. We discover what is real, we discover what is true, we discover what love means.
Well, of course, there's some people who think it, like Kant, who thought it was objective, but that doesn't mean that it involves a God. So I think there's a separate question of the extent to which ethics is objective rather than subjective, from the question of whether it's imposed by a God. And then, of course, there's a question of is the statement that God is good a tautology or not? So I think there are all these deep debates, and I'm not an expert in any of them, but I don't think we need to abandon the idea of improving people's lives by their own perceptions simply because we don't have any religious beliefs.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
I suppose that it, for me, that whole concept of the idea that one day humans might be replaced by robots, and the question of whether we could know actually whether they would actually have the same meaningful experience as us, even if they appeared to all intents and purpose, you know, appear to be having interactions. I mean, would it be a shame for you in that sense, Martin, if the ability to appreciate our place in the cosmos was ultimately lost, even if there was, you know, still apparently activity happening through these robotic people and so on?
No, very much so. That's why if our remote progeny are zombies, I would find it's a very depressing outcome. But of course, the universe isn't necessarily going to be the way that pleases us as humans. So that scenario isn't less likely to, because I don't like it. And so we've got to bear in mind that that could be a scenario, but also we should bear in mind that there could be far more wonderful entities out there already.
Who knows? Well, that would be a whole other show to explore.
Given the scale of the universe, we could be unique. But on the other hand, we're not.
Yes, it's been such an interesting conversation between you both. Any final thoughts as we end this? John, perhaps you'd like to start, and then I'll pass to Martin.
Well, just taking this conversation on, that what the Christian understanding of what it means to be human is, it explains the fact that there seems to be this mysterious link between us as these carbon-based life forms on a particular blue blob in the galaxy and this vast universe out there. And there is some kind of correspondence between what goes on in my mind and what is going on in reality. And that's the Christian answer for that, is because we are made in God's image, and therefore my mind is capable of thinking after the mind of the Creator, that there is a great mind behind reality, and my puny little human mind is capable, in some highly limited, and of course, I mean, I hear what Martin is saying, nonetheless, there is some kind of correspondence between my mind and the mind of the Creator. I think what Martin has to say is actually, as far as he knows, there is no mind behind the universe, and it's just an amazing fluke that this little carbon-based life form manages to do all these extraordinary things, including developing intelligence, reaching out, exploring the cosmos. And the question is, which of those two stories makes more sense?
Well, I mean, I certainly think it is remarkable that the human brain, which hasn't changed very much since our ancestors roamed the African savannah and knew about the everyday world, has made as much progress as it has in understanding the cosmos and the microworld of the quantum. I think that is remarkable. And of course, had that not been the case, we wouldn't have technology. But the brain has this. But of course, we don't know we're unique in the universe. There could be others, civilizations out there in space thinking just the same thoughts as you, thinking they're unique. So we just don't know that. But I would say one other thing, which is that we are perhaps nearer the beginning than the end of the emergence of complexity in the universe. We're the outcome of 4 billion years of Darwinian evolution, and the future evolution we've been discussing is going to be mainly perhaps electronic rather than biological, and it's going to be not Darwinian. It's going to be determined by in what I'd like to call secular intelligent design. Humans and their progeny designing better ones, and I think this has a big difference, because evolution by Darwinian selection favors two things. One is intelligence, another is aggression. And that leads some people to think that any advanced aliens are going to be aggressive. They want to come and conquer us, etc. Whereas the future evolution will favour intelligence, but not aggression. And so, for all we know, there are these electronic brains thinking deep thoughts out there in space, not bothering us at all. And it completely changes one's view about the likelihood of there being advanced intelligence elsewhere in the universe, if we believe that it's developed by what I call secular intelligent design. Mm. And so that's a possible scenario, because there could be places out in space where there's been a billion-year head start, because they formed on planets around older stars. So I just think, yes, we've got to bear in mind, yeah, the huge variety and the fact that we are still nearer the beginning than the end. Humans aren't the culmination. And that's one thing which I don't resonate with most religious people in believing.
Yeah, I mean, and yes, and if we do meet aliens one day, maybe there will be robots from another star system, who knows? But
Much more likely, in, yes, my opinion. Much more likely.
There you go. Whether that's something that inspires you or depresses you, we'll leave to the viewer to decide. But John and Martin, it's been just a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for being willing to engage in the way you have today. Really appreciated it. Again, if you want to find out more about both of the books that I've mentioned in regard to Martin and John, John's book is The Robot Will See You Now. Find that at johnwyatt.com. MartinRees.uk is the website of Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal, and we've mainly been touching on themes from his book On the Future, Prospects for Humanity. So again, that's available too, as well as his more recent book, The End of Astronauts. And of course, you can find this show. Do share it on with others. I hope it'll interest them and inspire them as well. But for now, Martin and John, thanks for being with me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this special edition of Matters of Life and Death. John's discussion with Martin Rees was originally broadcast as part of The Big Conversation, another great podcast hosted by Justin Brierley within the Premier Unbelievable Network. If you've enjoyed what you've heard over the past 3 weeks, do take a look at The Big Conversation online. That's thebigconversation.show. Justin has pulled together 4 seasons now of fascinating dialogues between big-name thinkers, discussing the most pressing questions in life, including Richard Dawkins, Rowan Williams, Jordan Peterson, Derren Brown, N.T. Wright, Tom Holland, A.C. Grayling, and many, many more. And as always, you can head to John's website, johnwyatt.com, for more of his own resources on things like AI, transhumanism, and the future of humanity. You can also get in touch with us by emailing molad@premier.org.uk. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.